acorns jumping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, furry as a mouse. It's a suey nature, a suey nature thing. It's a suey nature, a suey nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 157, Scary Stories. Monday, February 20th, 2017. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Each week, I post photographs, links to things I'm talking about, and show notes on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. Today's episode includes the following segments: The Back Porch, Off the Shelf, and The Front Porch. Hello, everyone. I hope you are well. It has been a quite mild and beautiful President's Day weekend here in the Delaware Water Gap. On Saturday, Samuel's band Bovine Social Club opened for Rusted Root in a nearby restored, beautifully restored theater in the town of Newton. And that was a very long but excellent day. They played to a sold-out house and got a lot of enthusiasm from the crowd that was gathered there to see Rusted Root. And then yesterday, Sunday, was just so sunny, warm, and wonderful that we took a little bit of a hike on the Appalachian Trail entrance that's right here in Delaware Water Gap, and we did a photo shoot for a forthcoming pattern of mine. The pattern is called Braided Berry Hat and Mitts. The mitts have been tested by test knitters, and the hat is currently being tested. And we used the ice cream parlor downstairs in this very building where I record to do a really fun photo shoot. It was just bathed in light, and there are some really exquisite furnishings in this place because the couple who bought this historic property and are lovingly restoring it are really excellent at finding amazing auction deals. And in this ice cream parlor, there are some furnishings that were sold at the auction from the Tavern on the Green in New York City, including the topiary squirrel. It's pretty famous. It's always sitting right out front now. And just some really beautiful furnishings. So a little bit of that was captured in the photographs, as well as the hat and mitts, very important. And I look forward to putting out that pattern pretty soon. There is another week, just over a week, in the Taproot make-along. It will close on March 1st, probably March 2nd. And then the podcast that I record immediately following that will be the one where I do the prize announcements. There are quite a few prizes for this make-along, and all you need to do is post in the thread on Ravelry about what you are making. There's no obligation to finish anything. Some folks are cooking, crafting, doing some of the knitting projects that are featured in the hands section of Taproot, and it has been a lot of fun. Working with you all, I will talk about my project a little further along in this episode. On the back porch is my best yet pair of hand-knitted socks. I've been on a quest to figure out my recipe for hand-knit socks that fit me, that are fun to knit, and with a set of directions that I can, over time, internalize. Most of the socks that I wear are athletic socks because for my professional wear, I tend to wear some sort of tights or pantyhose. I don't really wear socks on a daily basis except to take walks or in more casual situations. And the socks that I tend to wear are socks made for athletic wear. And one of the features that I really like in socks like that is a very energizing elasticity around the arch of the foot. It seems to really give my feet a lot of comfort. It makes them feel energized. It makes me feel more inclined to walk or pick up my steps. So I was trying to think of a way to recreate some of the fit and some of the things that I like in athletic socks in hand-knit socks. And so this is the recipe I came up with. I begin with a tubular cast on. I knit the socks cuff down and I knit them concurrently. So for this particular pair, I had two sets of US size 0 needles. I used my Hiya Sharps and my Carbons needles. And I cast on 64 stitches, tubular cast on. I knit 1x1 rib for about 20 rounds. And then I switched to a plain stockinette. I used the heel flap and heel turn and gusset from the Collie Wobbles socks by Emily of Fibertown. And then I use a very clever technique of picking up stitches, which is really challenging for me. And I tend to get a lot of very loose stitches, and it just doesn't seem durable in the heel of my sock until I started using the trick that Claire of New Hampshire Knits provided in her pattern for Agatha socks. And then after I finish the bottom of the heel gusset, I knit about 3 rounds or so of just plain stockinette. And then on the bottom of the foot only, so for 32 stitches across the bottom of the foot, I do 1x1 ribbing again for about 2 inches, a little over 2 inches. And after that, I just switch over to all stockinette in the round until it's time to start the toe decreases. And for these socks, I knit until I was about an inch, just over an inch from the tip of my toe. And then I did alternate decrease rounds and knit rounds until there were 18 stitches on each side, or let's see, a total of 36 stitches. And then I did the decrease round every round until there were 16 stitches. And then I did my Kitchener stitch close. Something else I tried on these socks, and I've been trying in knitting patterns recently, is to do a little bit of a different kind of decrease. I'll link in my show notes to a page, maybe you've seen it, about different kinds of SSK and knit two together and how well they are paired and how seamless and smooth they look. And there are some alternatives to the traditional slip-slip knit and knit two together. So for my slip-slip knit on these socks, I slipped the first stitch as if to knit, slip the second stitch as if to purl, and then purl knit them together through the back loop. And that's something I've heard a lot of knitters talk about before. Instead of the traditional knit two together, I used a KRPR stitch in which you knit a stitch and then you put that same stitch back onto the left needle. You pull the next stitch over that stitch you just knit, and then you transfer the stitch back onto the right needle. And this creates an SSK and a knit two together that are nearly identical, except that one slants to the left and one slants to the right. And I really enjoyed that using those decreases for these socks, I think they do make them look a bit more seamless. And I'm very pleased. I wore them on my walk yesterday on the hike we took, and I totally forgot about the fact that I was wearing hand-knit socks. To me, in my shoes, they gave me the same sort of arch support and really nice fit, really nice hugging of the heel that I find in my athletic socks. So I think I will be knitting some more socks with this recipe. And a pair of socks a month is a bit of a tall order for me at this point. I think that the routine I had last year was to knit about one pair of socks every 2 months is just about right. The yarn I used for these socks was Gnome Acres. It's the House Gnome base, just a superwash merino nylon, and the colorway was Ninja Cupcake, which had really pretty pinks, reds, black, and some pops of other colors. It kept my interest as I was knitting and was very festive, and my goal was to finish them up around Valentine's Day, which I did. So now I'm looking a little bit online for some yarn that could be suitable for March and April knitting. I'm thinking something in the greens family. And I do have some sock yarn waiting for one particular sock pattern that I know is forthcoming. But since that's not out yet, I think I may start another pair of these. I guess it's sort of my vanilla sock pattern. I might start another pair of these. And one improvement I may try is a double gusset on the bottom of the heel. Emily of Fibertown gave me some pattern tips to search, and I may add that double gusset to this next pair, but I have to find the yarn first. So I'll keep you posted. Off the shelf. This week I have completed the reading of Jacqueline Simpson's Icelandic Folktales and Legends. Some of the most elaborate stories are contained in the chapter on ghosts. A whole bunch of ghost stories in this book, and I thought I would share one of these with you today because I did fashion my own little pattern motif to go with this particular story called The Dead Man's Nightcap. On a farm beside a church, there lived, among others, a young boy and a girl. The boy made a habit of scaring the girl, but she had got so used to it that she was never frightened of anything. For if she did see something, she thought it was her brother trying to scare her. One day it so happened that the washing had been done, and that among the things there were many white nightcaps, such as were in fashion then. In the evening, the girl was told to fetch in the washing, which was out in the churchyard. She runs out and begins to pick up the washing. When she has almost finished, she sees a white specter sitting on one of the graves. She thinks to herself that the lad is planning to scare her. So she runs up and snatches the specter's cap off, for she thought the boy had taken one of the nightcaps from the washing. And she says, "Now don't you start trying to scare me this time." So she went indoors with the washing. The boy had been indoors the whole time. They started sorting out the washing, and there was one nightcap too many now. And it was earthy on the inside. Then the girl was scared. Next morning, the specter was still sitting on the grave, and people did not know what to do about it, as nobody dared to take the cap back. And so they sent word all around the district, asking for advice. There was one old man in the district who declared that it would be impossible to stop something bad from happening unless the girl herself took the cap back to the specter and placed it on its head in silence, and that there ought to be many people there to watch. The girl was forced to go with the cap and place it on the specter's head, and so she went, though her heart was not much in it, and she placed the cap on the head of the specter, and when she had done so, she said, "Are you satisfied now?" But at this, the dead man started to his feet, struck the girl, and said, "Yes, and are you satisfied?" And with these words, he plunged down into his grave. The girl fell down at the blow, and when men ran to pick her up, she was already dead. The boy was punished because he used to scare her, for it was considered that the whole unfortunate affair had been his fault, and he gave up scaring people. And that is the end of this tale. I've mentioned this before, that one of the features of these tales is that they've been recorded from oral tellings of the tales. And so in a lot of places, they almost seem like cliff notes of the tale, because for me, one of the features of a ghost story is it kind of draws out the suspense and the scary parts. And this seems like almost like two kids would talk on the bus about the story that they're having a quiz on when they get to school, and they would just review all of the essential parts of the narration without really retelling the story. That's the way it seems with a lot of these tales, which has a kind of a charm in it. It's sort of an archaeological, I suppose, way to familiarize yourself with these folk tales and legends. But another thing that turns up, and I know I've mentioned this before, is that the folks who recorded these faithfully recorded this very characteristic verb tense shift that happens. So the story will be going along in the past tense, and then all of a sudden it jumps to the present tense. And then sometimes there doesn't really seem to be any rhyme or reason for why the shift happens back and forth. I did a little bit of research on this, and one of the things that historians guess about this technique is that a sudden shift in verb tense brings the reader or the listener, more likely the listener, closer to the story. It signals that something happens that's a change from before. And one of the phrases that occurs quite frequently in these stories is something along the lines of, "And nothing much happened until..." Or, "There's nothing really to tell until..." It's just this signal that time has passed without anything really interesting or anything pertinent to the story. And so I think that these verb tense shifts emphasize that point. This is where something interesting is going to happen. It's kind of quaint, and I've really enjoyed not just the stories themselves, but also some of the notes that the editor here uses to talk about making comparisons between these tales and other tales, particularly in the Nordic tradition and also some European tales as well, that there's some similar themes running between them. So all this time during my reading of these legends and folk tales, I have been working on a stranded knitting project that was inspired by the journal cowl in Taproot. I used some of the motifs from that cowl, and I have made up some of my own. For this particular story, The Dead Man's Nightcap, I created a little motif featuring gravestones, gray gravestones on a red background. And then in white, I was trying to create a nightcap, but I couldn't really come up with anything. So instead, I went the more abstract route of something white, like a specter kind of floating off from the grave. It's a pretty simple but effective technique. So it's been a lot of fun to knit some of the motifs and make up some of my own. I think trying to fashion my own stranded knitting motifs gives me a better appreciation for how stranded knitting is put together and how patterning occurs. One of the great things about knitting this journal cowl is that it was 96 stitches around, which is divisible by many, many, many numbers. And that creates a lot of flexibility for your motifs because you could make patterns that are pretty big and pretty small, and everything will work with this 96 stitch circumference. The scarier story is what happens when you finish your cowl and you do this amazing epic Kitchener stitch, 96 stitches all the way around. You pull it off beautifully. You can't even tell where the seam is. And then you fill a tub with cool water and you submerge your freshly knitted cowl and you watch red dye overspread everything and turn many parts of your cowl pink. That's what happened to me on Saturday morning. That's my ghost story. In doing stranded knitting, I really didn't think about the possibility of the dye, and some of the colors were pretty rich maroon red. There was a bright red, there was also kind of a pinky red. And my thought about bleeding colors had to do with hand dyes, and I don't know, it didn't occur to me that this woolly wool would bleed and then it would bleed onto my other colors. And because I don't do laundry, because Yinhu doesn't have a washing machine or dryer, so I don't do laundry and I just don't think about these things. I take my things to a service to have them washed. And because I've heard things about using a citric acid bath and doing this whole procedure before you use yarns, but I've kind of tuned it out because I don't have a microwave either. And so it just seemed like a lot of steps, and I've never had a problem with anything bleeding before, which we know is not a reliable way to know if you won't have a problem with bleeding in the future. But I didn't think about that. And now my cowl is, I think it's ruined. I don't think it's salvageable. I've had a few days to process it. I had a really good time knitting it. I enjoyed the yarn immensely. I feel like this was more of a process knit than a product, although having the product would certainly be a wonderful thing and a great memory of all of these stories, like a trigger almost to retell the stories. I guess my biggest regret is that I used the beautiful Cornish Tin 2 in knitting this. I used almost an entire skein. That yarn it's not hype. It is excellent, lovely yarn to work with. And it's pink. A lot of it's pink now. So even trying to take out the project, it's in a million pieces anyway, but I don't think it would be salvageable because I think the color of it is kind of destroyed. So I have always been of the mind that taking a lot of precautions with yarn is just like a lot of extra, likely unnecessary steps. But if I compare those procedures to what I go through with my sewing projects, it would never occur to me to just start cutting into fabric and sewing it without having it laundered first. So why don't I take those precautions with the yarn? If I had done that, I wouldn't be so disappointed right now. So lesson learned, and being that I do have some additional stranded knitting in my future, I guess I need to figure out a way to carry out some procedures for preventing yarn bleeding that don't require a microwave, because I don't have one, don't want one in my kitchen at Yinhu. So I'll be doing a little research, and if any of you have tips about what to do without a microwave, I would like to hear them. I suppose I could have used some kind of a color catcher in the water. I was smart enough not to use super hot water, but still there was the bleeding. So that's my scary story and my even scarier story. Thank you for listening. I feel that I've done a nearly complete recovery. I haven't had a lot of knitting mishaps in my rather short knitting career. And a lot of that I attribute to having watched and listened to podcasts and really heard about mistakes that people made and how they rethought their process to include more precautions and to work toward a better result. So if anything, I hope that sharing this story is a precaution to you, especially if you've kind of dismissed these tales in the past as things that could never happen to your knitting, because I'm living proof that they can happen. The front porch. After completing quite a few projects this past week, I finished the socks that I told you about. There was the tragic story of my cowl, tragic but concluded. And I've also concluded knitting and pattern writing for my own pattern, and I have test knit a pattern for another podcaster. Hopefully you'll be hearing about that soon from her. So I had a lot of projects off the needles, which means it's time to get started thinking about what's going on my needles. And one thing that happens to me, I don't know if this happens to you, but when something happens that has been kind of out of my control or I don't feel in control, like the story with the cowl, I take excessive control over other things. And usually this kind of behavior is organizational behavior that I exert on my personal belongings. So if something bad happens or unexpected, suddenly it's really important for me to get very organized. And so I went into my stash and I started organizing it. I took photographs of quite a few yarns that have gone into my stash without being recorded on Ravelry. And then I went into my queue and I tried to match up some patterns I've been thinking about knitting with yarn that I have in my stash. And that felt very good. And I did come up with a list of three tops that I would like to knit for spring and the yarns that I would use in stash to do all of that knitting. So that felt like an accomplishment. And then I discovered some yarn that I didn't know what I wanted to do with it. So I have some woolly wools, some 100% wool yarns. They aren't yarn that I really want to wear, but I want to work with it. They would be perfect for felting. And so I started to think about making a felted bag. And I think this would be the great spring project, because in summertime, it's just so handy to have a really durable, beautiful bag. I do a lot of festival going and we go on day trips and things like that. And you always just need a really great bag to tuck a lot of things into. And wouldn't it be great if this were a handmade felted bag? So I have had in my queue for a very long time the Sun Satchel by Stephen West, which has this beautiful radiating starburst pattern on it. There's a front and a back that are knit identical, and then a long band that's seamed. So it creates depth for the bag and also a shoulder strap. This pattern looks pretty simple, pretty fun to knit. I have done felting before, so I feel relatively confident with that. And one of the yarns I discovered, these 100% wool yarns, is this brilliant, brilliant red. So I think I will be treating that red to make sure it doesn't bleed. But I think that against some really dark greens and browns and grays, a lot of the other colors I have in these woolly wools are pretty drab. And I think that would be a really nice contrast and would be a great summertime bag. So that's in my plans, plus the three tops. Plus then I started to take note of all of the scrap yarn that I have. I have quite a bit of leftover yarn from socks and from other fingering weight projects, a little bit of sport weight. There might even be some DK in there. And I've just been saving it all in this hand-woven box that I have sitting next to my desk. And it's really overflowing. It's to the point where I need to put something heavy on the lid of the box to keep the lid down because the scrap yarn is just coming out. In the past, I've done some scrap yarn projects. There's one linen stitch shawl, especially with a beautiful fringe that you create where you don't have to tie in or weave in any of your ends. You just tie them off and leave them as a fringe on the edge of the scarf. I have knit two of those in the past, but it's linen stitch, so it's a pretty time-consuming project. And I just wanted something where I could use up some of this scrap yarn. I haven't put any warp on my loom yet, so weaving was out. And I just found myself starting one of these crochet stripe blankets. This could be the scariest story of all because I tend to resist things that it seems like a lot of other people are doing. There's just something in me that if a lot of people are doing it, I just feel like I need to not do that thing. But I do have a lot of experience with crochet. I started my involvement in the fiber arts by learning how to crochet. That's why I'm a continental knitter, because I already know how to hold the yarn in my left hand. I'm pretty fast at crochet, and I think this is a reasonable project for me because I just want something that's big enough to be a lap blanket or to take on a picnic or somewhere where I might be sitting in the ground. And during the spring and summer months, I do a lot of that because I go to a lot of shows and festivals. We go on hikes and picnics and things. So I cast on for this granny stripe blanket. I cast on about 140, 50 stitches. Not anything elaborate. It's probably about 40 inches long. And then I just started using up my scrap yarn. It's all in one bag now. It's all been contained in one bag. And I have quite a few neutrals to, I think, help with transitions between widely varying colors that I have in my scrap yarn. I'm trying not to overthink anything. I'm just trying to use up this yarn into a useful thing. And so far, it's going well. So I probably won't talk about this project again until it's complete and I can show you a photograph of it. But it is nice to return to crochet. It's amazing how quickly things work up. It's so much quicker than knitting. And it feels good to be working on this project. It's something good for when my brain is drained and I really don't have the capacity to think about a lot of directions and steps. And I can just sit down with that project and go. Thanks for listening, everyone. I have been thinking about a potential make-along for summer tops or maybe even for felting projects. But since the taproot make-along is still in progress, I haven't firmed up any plans for that at this point. If you have an interest in either one of those, I hope you will let me know and maybe we can plan something for later on in the year. Hey,
jumping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, furry as a mouse. It's a suey nature, a suey nature thing. It's a suey nature, a suey nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves lay down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a it's a suey nature, a suey nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. The theme song for this episode is Sweet, music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, recorded by Bovine Social Club. If you enjoy this episode, I hope you'll consider joining the Ravelry group or the Facebook page, following me on social media, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Each week, I post show notes, links, and photographs of the things I talk about on my website, yarns@yinhu.com. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a mighty fine, a mighty fine nature thing. Two stoves out there stoving, a chipmunk on the lawn, six turkeys up in munching like fat hogs. It's a suey nature, a suey nature thing. It's a suey nature, a suey nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature is gonna get you high. You better tell your face to smile. Jump in a river naked and hang a country mile. It's a sweet nature, a sweet nature thing. It's a sweet nature, a sweet nature thing. It's a mighty fine, it's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing.